This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
In this episode of Around the Coin, I interview Cormac Kinney. Cormac is the CEO and founder of Diamond Standard. Diamond Standard has raised about $24 million, and they have about $75 million worth of sales, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of sales of their diamonds. So what Diamond Standard is doing is they're standardizing the diamond trade industry. So traditionally, the $1.5 trillion worth of diamonds had not been traded on any market because diamonds are inconsistent, unlike gold, which is very consistent. So Diamond Standard creates the Diamond Standard. They create a little coin and a little block that has a standard value, and then they allow people to trade that. We talked about all the other complexities of the business and what they're doing in the future, and how he views diamonds as a very huge upside from an investment perspective. Diamonds has remained relatively flat for a long, long time, unlike gold and other precious metals. So I asked him just about everything I could think of as to why this wouldn't be a good idea. And I'm convinced that he's right and they're really onto something big. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I hope you learn a lot about the diamond industry and consider it a place you could, you know, maybe invest or think about investing, or at least learn more about how precious metals and diamonds work. So I bring you Cormac Kinney, the founder and CEO of Diamond Standard. Cormac, excited to be chatting with you. I love what you're working on.
Yeah, me too.
I love the innovative idea of taking real world commodities, real world items, and then pegging them on chain. It feels like a good, healthy use of tokenization. You hadn't been in the diamond industry before. You're more in fintech. You've been working on Diamond Standard for a while. Give me the state of where we are today. So we're in the end of April. You have approval to launch the ETF, I believe, but haven't launched it yet. Can you tell me more where you guys are today?
Sure. Well, it took us years to get to build the tech stack, number one, but also we walked very slowly with our regulators to get approval. And now we have the world's only regulatory license for a commodity token. What that means is someone who receives our token, that's regulator approved settlement, for example, for futures contracts. So far we have approval for futures and options. But we're shipping. We've been shipping for about a year, Diamond Standard commodities. We've sold tens of millions. We've bought hundreds of thousands of diamonds. So it's very real.
Hmm. And that's, you sold tens of millions of dollars, US dollars worth of diamonds?
Yeah, per quarter. It's funny. Yeah. Diamonds are this forgotten commodity. That unlike gold and silver, almost every large investor has gold and silver. I can't name one PIMCO, BlackRock, State Street. They don't have a single diamond between them, but they all, obviously they've all heard of diamonds. They all know about them. It's just diamonds are never available for investors. And it was really the blockchain was the final ingredient that made that possible.
Is there some characteristic of diamonds? Well, I would think, generally speaking, individual consumer retail investors might just casually overlook it because they're not that sophisticated. But institutional investment funds, it strikes me as surprising that they wouldn't have that as part of their portfolio if there's some other reason that's not obvious. Is there?
Yeah, well, the problem with diamonds is that every diamond is a little bit different. And they have this, the carat weight, the color, the clarity. Those factors have a huge impact on the value. And, you know, a 10 carat D flawless diamond might be $1 million a carat versus a tiny little 10th of a carat diamond might be hundreds of dollars a carat. So they're exponential, which makes them complicated. And there's never been a single investment product that's ever been approved by regulators for diamonds, because there was never a way to mark to market. There's no price transparency. There's no exchange. And therefore, there's no liquidity. And the friction, if an investor were to try to trade diamonds 2 years ago, they'd probably go to Sotheby's and Christie's and pay 18% commissions each way. The breakthrough that we've accomplished was we made diamonds into a fungible commodity, really for the very, very first time. And that allows you to have a singular product that you can trade and hold.
So by contrast, gold feels like it's been traditionally highly traded. Is that because all gold is the same? It's just like water in a bucket. Is that ultimately what it boils down to?
Exactly. So with gold, you have a purity, 0.999% pure, and you have a weight, you know, like 1,000 grams for a kilo bar. Or 400 ounce is the normal bar that's in a vault. But regardless how big the bar is, gold is priced per ounce, like $1,932 an ounce. So they're fungible. You can always trade gold just by doing that simple math. With diamonds, there is no simple math. And their breakthrough that we made was a computer science breakthrough, which is using automated market making for price discovery, statistical sampling for aggregating a unit, and optimization for putting them all together into a package, which I'm sure you've seen is like a bar containing diamonds. This bar, all of the information we had to publish on a blockchain so that we can never change it. And it always proves that every bar is equivalent. So every bar has different diamonds, but they add up to be equivalent. And then the real breakthrough is that once you have that token, you can now trade it. And whoever owns the token owns the bar, which is generally sitting in a vault like Brinks or JP Morgan.
So the standardization of the diamonds with that little plastic bar is what moves it from the individual diamond aspect of it to more of the gold analogy where it's just water flowing. So is it that...
Exactly.
Is it that somebody would assess each of those diamonds and say, okay, this one's 700, this one's worth 500, let's add them up, and how would that...
not anymore.
Yeah.
So these two bars are assembled under regulatory supervision and audited by Deloitte as that whole process. So we can prove mathematically, every coin is public, every bar is public, every diamond is public. We can prove that these, I don't know how many diamonds, maybe 10 diamonds, that these 10 diamonds, they're a variety of carat weight, color, and clarity. But the way they add up, they're optimized so that these 10 diamonds are equivalent to these 10 diamonds. And the CME has agreed that these bars are what's called good for delivery. That if you have a futures contract, you have to deliver 10 bars. It doesn't matter which 10. It doesn't matter if they were made this year or if they were made 20 years from now. Any 10 bars contain equivalent diamonds, and those bars will all settle a futures contract or an ETF basket.
Hmm. And the company you guys have raised, what I found, tell me if this is wrong, but it looked like you had raised about $24 million privately for the company, and then there's an additional... You had a $50 and a $75 million round that's specifically for pre-allocation for the ETF. Is that right?
Well, you're combining a couple things. We've raised a lot of equity. We have a lot of hedge fund investors. We have a BlackRock executive fund was our first big investor. And our largest investor today is Horizon Kinetics, which is a great contrarian fund. They launched the INFL ETF last year, which took off. And that's equity in the company. That's kind of who's behind us. And then we've had offerings for the commodity. The commodity always launches with an IPO. And we, for example, we never decide how much a bar sells for. And we also didn't decide how many diamonds go in each bar. That was discovered through a regulator-supervised initial offering. And so we've done a $25 million initial offering for the coin. We're right now doing a $75 million initial offering for the bar. This is the coin. So we offered $25 million of this to calibrate what are the contents that have to go into every coin. And now we're doing that same process for the bar. Since then, we did several other $50 million offerings. And now we're preparing to launch a fund, which is $500 million. So it's scaling up.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the fund. Well, first, the difference between the bar and the coin is just the amount of diamonds in there. How much does it work?
Yeah, it's actually, mathematically, it's very interesting. The bar is always 10 times the coin. And what you'll notice is that all the diamonds in the coin are much smaller. All the diamonds in the bar are much larger. So it's actually the same number of diamonds, and it's not tremendously more weight. These are about 3 carats. These are about 8 carats, 7 or 8 carats. But these diamonds, because they're all larger, they're about 10 times the value on average. And mathematically, the bars are always 10 times the price of the coin. Today, I don't know the market price, but I think it's around 6,700. Mm-hmm. So these are 67,000 for the bar.
Wow. Man, you got an intern right around the corner that's just going to come in there. And I mean, clearly storing those is very important. It's worth more than a Tesla sitting in your hand. Have more than those sitting in your desk? I mean, from an individual's perspective, would that make sense for them to have? If you show me 20 of these things, oh God.
Come on by.
And so I imagine there's got to be a big safe, right? People have to be.
No. So we never store the customers' coins and bars. No. In fact, we never touch them. And all of our, we had to build a special facility in partnership with Brinks. And the funny thing I learned is that gold has a sales tax exemption. If you buy a bar of gold, there's no sales tax. But if you buy diamonds, no matter what their shape they're in, you pay sales tax, except in Delaware and a few other states like New Hampshire and Alaska. So we had to build a vault with Brinks. It's operated by Brinks in Delaware. So 99% of our clients, they store their bars and coins at Brinks. About 1% of our clients, they say, I want it in my sock drawer. And we deliver to the client wherever they want.
Okay. So interesting. How old are those laws? So we have states that have some states have no sales tax, others do. Is that hundreds of years old for some reason?
At least 50 years. So Delaware, different states have different tax regimes. So Delaware has no sales tax for anything. So that's why they were our pick. And there's a lot of gold bullion depositories in Delaware. New Hampshire has no sales tax. Florida has a high sales tax, but they have no income tax. Mm-hmm. So you kind of pick and choose which states you use for different investments.
Yeah. Hey, I'm in Oregon. There's no sales tax here. It's a nice perk.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's also there might be gold vaults. I don't know. I don't know of any Oregon gold vaults.
Yeah. Maybe they're all
Texas has a bunch.
Do they have no sales tax in Texas?
No sales tax on gold.
Oh, interesting how they have those exclusions. And so people, when they purchase these, are 99% of the time doing it as an investment. They're not, they don't have intention to open the casing and then do something practical with it in most cases.
Well, even the ones who take delivery, they don't plan to crack it open. Because if you crack open the bar, you now have 10 loose diamonds. those loose diamonds have, now you have all the friction of trading loose diamonds. If you buy a diamond at Tiffany's and you try to sell it on 47th Street, they'll offer you 40 cents on the dollar. That's why having a fungible unit, this trades at a market price. So there's very, very little slippage, low friction. So even the people who take it at home, they don't plan to crack it open and turn it into a bracelet, for example. So I think all of our investors are all of our buyers are investors, for sure.
Mm. When people do that, when they would purchase these or really any commodity, say like gold, the underlying assumption in the price is that there's somebody who would find practical use from that gold. They would turn it into, they'd either gold coat something, or they'd use a diamond for diamond rings. If, for instance, tomorrow we decided as a society that nobody wanted to use diamond rings on engagement rings, there would be a drop in the value of diamonds, I would assume.
For sure.
To some degree. Nothing would have changed for the people who have their diamonds in the vault inside those blocks. Is there an estimate you have as to the percentage of, I don't know what you call it, but like valuable diamonds out on the market that are headed for wedding rings or engagement rings versus those that are just locked up?
So, well, it's very interesting. If you look at gold, let's take gold as an example. And you mentioned people use gold as for jewelry, people use it for electronics, people use it as a store of wealth or an investment. And gold is the leader. About 30% of all the gold in the world is locked up in a vault, and it'll never get used on a computer circuit, for example, and it'll probably never get used for jewelry, but it could be. And if you go down the precious metals, down to platinum or palladium, about 15 to 17% of all the platinum and palladium of the world is locked up in a vault. Store of wealth, hedge, investment, and it'll never get used for a catalytic converter, for example. But it could be. You're right. So for diamonds, 100% of diamonds, 99.8% of diamonds are used for jewelry. The 0.02 is used for industrial use. And that's fallen off rapidly because now they use synthetic diamonds for drill bits, for example. So for the first time, and of diamonds, maybe 1 or 2% are used for investments. And that's the ones that go through Sotheby's, those pink diamonds, those blue diamonds. The vast majority of diamonds that are owned by anybody are in jewelry. 99% of diamonds are in jewelry. So we've created the first application for an investment because we've made this fungible unit that you can buy and trade and store very easily, mark to market if you're a fund. So we think that percent of diamonds used for investment will go from 1% to 15%, 15% being the amount of palladium investors hold. So the investment thesis actually is very simple. Regardless of what happens in the jewelry world, diamonds are going to go from 1% closer to 15% as far as use in investments. And that is going to, that's about 10 years of demand, of supply, and that's got to drive prices up. So just the process of investors building positions for the first time, we think that drives the demand and impacts the price.
And do you see that from almost a higher level abstract view that if you have some commodity that's being utilized in the world, that if there's a 99% utilization ratio, let's call it, from everything that's, say, corn, right? If corn was coming out of the ground and the only people utilizing corn were the people who are eating it or selling it upstream for someone else to be consumed, do you view there's some optimization on these commodities where if you had 15%, for instance, you mentioned of diamonds, if 15% were in the trading market, then investors could more or less regulate or have an influence on the price. Whereas if that number got to be 90%, then it seems to me that would be incredibly unstable because the 10% who are actually utilizing it might throw the 90% all the time. Whereas on the other side, if you had, as we do today with diamonds, 99% are not being used for trading, then there's kind of, do you see that as creating an inelastic pricing model where there's incredible variance all over the place? People don't really know what things are worth because there's not an open market. Is that the right like boundary conditions to think of?
Well, yeah. So in metals and oils, you always look at the supply and the demand. And in metals and some other things too, there's always a substitution effect. Mm. So that if certain commodities like oil, if oil gets far too high, more people will shift to natural gas, for example, or coal. So prices can have this elasticity effect and an inelasticity with when the substitution becomes available. For diamonds, we've only had one thing to look at, which is jewelry demand. And last year, jewelry demand was off the chart because a lot of everybody was home for COVID. Oh, yeah.
Ah.
So in every continent, jewelry went up in demand, and they projected to go up about 5% per year for the next 5 years. So jewelry demand is going up. At the same time, diamond mines have been exhausted. So Rio Tinto closed two of their largest mines. There is not one single diamond mine operating in Australia. Australia used to produce about 12 to 15% of diamonds. They're all empty. Not one mine.
It's all in
so
Russia.
So diamonds, yeah, we'll talk about that next. But so diamond production overall, including Russia, is falling by 2 to 3% per year. And jewelry demand is rising by 2 to 7% per year. So that alone is a really good indicator of the demand increasing over the supply and driving prices up. Diamond prices, by the way, are up 45% in the last little over a year.
How are prices, well, before I ask you that, why would jewelry be up when people are home alone? Is it because I generally think of jewelry as something you buy to show off when you go out.
Well, that's the thing. You can't go out. So for 2021, nobody could go out. Nobody could travel. And all they could do is sit at home and shop. So Tiffany's had their best year. Signet had their best years. Richemont, which owns Cartier, had a tremendous growth. Yeah, it was just people stuck at home without the ability to travel and spend on hotels and resorts. They put a lot of that money into jewelry. At the same time, a bunch of the diamond mines were shut down for months because of COVID outbreaks. And so you have right now diamond inventories are at the all-time low worldwide.
That's interesting. It's counterintuitive to me, but I can see it. You know, people are just home alone shopping, even with no one to show off their jewelry to. But I guess that changes. How is the price established today in the diamond world? If there's no exchange where people are actively trading diamonds, is there kind of a centralized like GIA body that just says this is what things are worth today? Or how is it done?
Yeah. So historically, well, the GIA, they grade the diamonds and they don't give any comments on value. They only say it's carat weight, color, it's clarity, et cetera. Historically, there was this, there's this group called Rappaport that puts out a wholesale index. And this wholesale index is just a printed sheet once a week or once a month that just has a round numbers to the rounded to the hundreds of dollars per carat. What they've been told through a survey are the market prices of all the diamonds.
Survey. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to say they're all liars, but if you ask a diamond dealer, hey, what are diamonds going for? Is he going to tell you a high number or a low debt number?
Yeah.
He's going to tell you a high number. So these surveys are useless to investors. And that was the first thing we had to build is part of our breakthrough is that we built the world's first actual electronic diamond exchange. And we buy all of our diamonds using automated market making. We bid on diamonds every day. We buy on the order of, you know, 30 to 50,000 diamonds a week. And through that process, we force the market to tell us what, you know, price discovery, what is every diamond worth? That never existed before Diamond Standard.
That's interesting. Congrats on that. That's a big move. Because it feels like
it was fun.
These individual wholesaler or traders or retailers, they when there's no centralized exchange, no way to tell the price transparency, like you said, they just say, oh, this is worth 3,000. And in reality, that might be a diamond that's traded more like 2,200. So there, that's kind of when I think of the value that you're providing to the world, that to me feels like that's a big chunk of it, at least, which is the individual consumer.
Yeah, that's half.
Yeah, this is what it's actually worth in the market because we can see it. People are trading for it.
That's exactly right. So half of our company is the price discovery side, which is the exchange, and half of it is the standardization company. Once we've discovered the value, we have to force each coin to have the same yardstick every time. And the way it works is between the coin and the bar, we can actually use about 94% of all the varieties of diamonds, every size, color, clarity. We don't care what you have. We have a bid. And so we actually make 16 million bids a day for different types of diamonds. And we just raise our bids until somebody in the world says yes for every category every week.
16 million bids a week. 60 million bids a day. What does that mean exactly? Yeah. There's a marketplace where you're...
So, bidding? Yeah, we if you take all the ranges of carat weight, so for example, there can be about 200 different carat weights that can fit in here, each diamond. There are 9 different colors. There are 11 different clarities, flawless, VS1, VVS2. All of those different characteristics, there's the fluorescence of the diamonds, the shape. You take all of those different combinations of factors, multiply them together, and there's 16 million different combinations for one individual diamond. Mm. So no matter what diamond anybody has, on a daily basis, we make a cash bid. That if your diamond has 0.33 carats, G color, VVS clarity, medium blue fluorescence, here's your bid. And we bid sight unseen. And what we're bidding on is to discover the cheapest to deliver commodity price worldwide. We actually have intake offices in 8 countries around the world. Several in India, Hong Kong, Israel, Belgium, London. So wherever the diamonds are, we make a cash bid. Somebody says yes. They deliver locally in Hong Kong, for example. We inspect the diamond there, and then our exchange moves the diamonds wherever they need to go in bulk. So what we've created is the first process to force the market to discover what's the value of every type of diamond. Now, we don't buy 16 million diamonds. What we buy is a statistical sample out of those 16 million. And then we can prove that this week's sample, which might be only 10,000 diamonds, but this week's sample statistically matches the standard.
I see. Okay. And because you're purchasing these diamonds, you're getting real world market data on pricing. You're saying this is what somebody's actually going to trade for it. Does that vary?
And you might have two. Absolutely. So. Yeah. And you might have two diamonds at different points, but they're very close together. You might have a diamond 0.33 and one that's 0.38. Well, you can guess 0.37654. Right. You can guess those are on a continuation of that curve. So yeah, the prices vary dramatically between, I'll give you a good example. If a diamond crosses the finish line and gets to 1 carat, for example. So from 0.99 to 1 carat, that's a big jump in value because so many girlfriends, they want a 1 carat. They don't want a 0.99 carat. Tiffany's doesn't have a single 0.99 carat diamond anywhere in the world because they know their consumers want 1 carat. My computer, though, doesn't care about retail. It's looking at the geology. So 99 carats versus 1 carat, it means that's right. a 1% difference to my computer.
Right.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah. And that's where having the real world price purchasing history makes a lot of sense, because you can pick up on these intangibles, which I think of, if the vast majority of diamonds are being used for jewelry purposes, then it's all like, well, does the size of the diamond matter more, or the cut, or the clarity? Or it's completely up to whatever people desire, right? And that must vary
yeah.
across different cultures. Like, I don't know what, I saw a stat that 85% of engagement rings in the US have diamonds in them. That may be off, but does that sound about right?
I think it's even, higher than that. Yeah.
And does that vary tremendously? Like some cultures that say engagement rings aren't even a part of their culture, which, do you have an idea?
No, De Beers did a good job. They've gotten that globally. But there are differences. For example, in Japan, they prefer smaller, finer diamonds. Like, you're more likely to have a half carat D flawless. Americans would rather have a big diamond, like Texas style. They'd rather have a 2 carat KSI2, you know. So, but you don't see that in China. You don't see that in Japan at all. So it does differ globally. But diamonds are a very global business because they're so easy to transport. They just move them wherever they get the best price. That's why we had to buy globally. The key for us is that cash on the barrel head, that's the only thing that's good enough for a regulator if you need to mark to market, because we do that every week. If you're PIMCO and you have $40 million worth of coins and bars, you can mark them to market. You know what they're all worth every single day. And that's the key to an investor.
What is PIMCO again?
PIMCO is a giant pension and fund manager out in California. I don't know how many they manage trillions.
And they're an active trader in the diamond industry?
No. That's just an example of a giant institutional investor.
Oh, got it.
PIMCO can't hold anything that they can't report at least once a month. What is the market value?
I see.
And that was always the problem with diamonds, is if you can't report a regulator acceptable valuation, you just can't hold it.
Right. Interesting. So you open up the market for them. What do you view the, like when I think about diamonds and I think about what people are willing to pay for them, and so much of it does depend on jewelry, and De Beers and the campaign strategy to have engagement rings it's almost so embedded in our society that I would think that tradition has gone back thousands of years. It hasn't. If you reflect on what De Beers did, what do you view as their insight to the collective psychology of human beings that's allowed them to be so successful in distributing this story, this myth worldwide, and then having it stick and be as pervasive as it is? I mean, it can't be something as simple as just running ads on TV. What's your take on what
you did? So, I mean, diamonds, you think of the pirates. Think back to the day of pirates, way before De Beers. Pirates always loved diamonds. Diamonds have always been valuable, back to the Maharishis of India. You know, and the Queen of England has had diamonds since the 1600s. So diamonds have always been valuable. De Beers really started by cornering the distribution. And what they did is they got the license to distribute the diamonds from most of the mines in Africa and all of the mines in Russia. And so back in the 50s through the late 80s, De Beers controlled distribution. Now, they also owned a few of the mines, but most of the mines they didn't own. They just had the distribution deal. And then they would revenue share with the Russian government. What their breakthrough was, and it really was in the 40s, was, and maybe the 30s, was to turn diamonds into an engagement ring. And it would start with the diamond is forever. That was like the real breakthrough, and they really hammered home the idea of engagement rings. and it being accessible. And they had the distribution to go along with that marketing, where they would supply the diamonds to the jewelry stores and promote that and support it with advertising. So it really was. It was Ogilvy and Mather and De Beers who created that whole messaging. Now, fast forward to the late 90s, De Beers got completely broken up, where Russia said, no, De Beers, we're going to distribute on our own. Several of the African countries said, we're done with this. We want to earn it. And so that marketing really came to an end. And today, De Beers only supplies about 22% of the world's diamonds. And they're a public company. It's part of Anglo American. And it also answers an important question. A lot of people think De Beers controls the supply. They don't have much of an inventory. On average, they have about 90 days of supply. There's no secret stockpile that they can, add up or hold back. So really the market controls the diamonds these days.
Was the pressure to get rid of De Beers because these countries realized how much power De Beers had in distributing diamonds and they just wanted a big piece of that? Or?
Yeah, part of it was Botswana, for example. They really, in Namibia, they really wanted more control. They wanted to use the revenue from diamonds to develop the country. And they really have very, very successfully. De Beers just launched their fifth ship that is mining diamonds off the coast of Africa. It's a 50-50 joint venture with the government now. When before, the government got very little. There was a lot of payola back in the early, 20th century, as you can imagine. Russia, at the time they were still, it was before the Berlin Wall came down, so it was still communist. And they wanted to control their supply. And today about 30% of the world's diamonds are actually found in Russia and distributed by Alrosa. And they sell them directly. They get 100% of the proceeds. They used to split 50-50 with De Beers. So yeah, it's a huge, I can't remember. It's like $15 billion a year or something for Russia by distributing their diamonds.
Yeah, significant. Not insanely large. I think the diamond market is 1.4, 1.5 trillion. Does that sound right?
Well, that's the above ground supply. So if you add up all the diamonds that have been found at today's market value, that's worth about $1.4 trillion, which, by the way, is more than all the silver, all the platinum, and all the palladium combined. So diamonds are second only to gold in above ground value. Gold is much more valuable, about $9 trillion. So it's a lot more. But the total production of diamonds per year is on the order of 40 billion, 30 to 40 billion. And that's at its terminal value, cut, polished, sold at retail, basically.
And what would you identify as major trends going on? Certainly, I'm sure people ask you about this, but the synthetic diamond market has to be growing, I would imagine. People are compelled by the attractiveness of make it in a lab as opposed to dig up a mine somewhere.
The fiancé does not want a synthetic diamond. And if you just look at the sales volume and growth, both are growing. Synthetic diamonds are gaining in acceptance. Their value has gone down. It's plummeted. And actually, De Beers they really surprised everyone. They were the largest producer of synthetic diamonds.
Wow.
And what they did is they cut the price viciously. They wanted to create daylight between natural and synthetic. So now a synthetic diamond is like 25 cents on the dollar to a natural diamond. And the problem is they have no resale value. You could never resell a synthetic diamond. Natural diamonds, they always have resale value. And now you just need equipment. But what I don't like about synthetic diamonds is that it's like, one person can run 100 machines. And so it doesn't really create jobs or economic substance. And there's some cryptocurrencies I feel the same way about, there's no value behind some of them. But in the case of lab-grown diamonds, what we expect is that natural diamonds are going to go up tremendously in price, mainly because of the demand from investors. As investors buy more natural diamonds to use as a hedge, as a store of wealth, or for speculation, it's going to drive up natural diamonds. And then synthetic diamonds will be the substitution effect, mm-hmm. where they just become so expensive that the Zales of the world, the mall jeweler, is going to, I think, switch largely to synthetic diamonds. And it'll be a little more like fashion.
Yeah.
It's something you wear and throw away. Maybe you recycle the gold.
Yeah. Yeah. Given that it is entirely subjective what diamonds are worth to people, right? If there was a giant marketing campaign tomorrow that said, put in, I don't know, what's another element? I can't think of anything. Put in silver into diamonds. I mean, silver would probably be a bad example because there's so much history there, but put in some new element that we don't traditionally use. The percentage of engagement rings that use diamonds drop 90%. Not saying this is likely to happen, but that it is not solving an explicit functional problem in the world, which doesn't take anything away from the concept of that. You know, all of entertainment doesn't solve an explicit problem the way saying like, you know, a water bottle provides functional value. in that scenario, it is it's amorphous, right? It's up to what the market determines it's worth. And therefore, just like the De Beers marketing campaigns were influential to get people to buy diamond engagement rings, that wave could flow in another direction. Eventually it will. Eventually people will flow in some other...
Could be. I don't know. Diamonds have been around. They've withstood the test of time. They're a very scarce, natural resource. Like I said, the diamond mines, they haven't found a new diamond mine in 25 years.
That's crazy.
Diamond mines are extinct. Yeah, they're extinct volcanoes.
Oh.
And the last ones they found were in Canada, at the Arctic Circle of Canada. Those mines turned out to be very small. They only lasted, one lasted 6 years, the other one lasted 11 years. The African mines have all lasted 50 years. The Australian mine lasted 37 years. And when they're empty because the volcano creates the diamonds millions over millions of years. And once you're out of that pipe, you're done. It's called the kimberlite pipe. So now De Beers, the only thing they can find are diamonds that have washed out to sea over millions of years. When a river intersects one of those volcanoes, they wash out all the diamonds out to sea. So now they're out picking those up, but they haven't found a new mine. So diamonds are like the original Bitcoin. They're decentralized, right? They're so small. This is $6,700. This is 13 grams. And diamonds are $1 million an ounce on average. The diamonds in these coins and bars,
wow,
if you weigh just the diamonds, not the plastic, that's $1 million an ounce compared to gold is $1,900 an ounce. So here's the new use case for diamonds that doesn't work with any other material on earth. Because they're crystals and they're in this plastic and you can still authenticate the diamonds. You can look at the crystal. You can look at the imperfections. You can match this to the certificate. Because they're so small, they can be sealed with electronics. So inside every coin, there's a wireless computer chip. It's that white layer. That chip makes this a blockchain asset. It stores a blockchain address and the public key. That makes this asset able to be attached to a smart contract. It's able to asset back a digital currency. And that digital currency, the value of, if you have a currency that's 1/10,000th of this, you know what it's worth because it trades on the CME as a commodity. So we think the use case for diamonds are that it can asset back a decentralized universal currency that, because this is hardware, we can actually deploy that currency onto any blockchain. And it always has the same value regardless of what platform it's on. There's no other resource on earth that provides that use case. And it's a use case for people who want a currency with an asset behind it. And that's actually a lot of people.
Is it a rational desire in your view? Or is it just kind of
to have an asset behind it?
Yeah.
It's human nature.
Yeah.
You know, every currency before the euro started with something behind it, gold usually. Yeah. Shells. Yeah. There were a few things.
Yeah.
But it had an asset behind it. And that asset generally had economic substance, right? You can't just find gold on a beach. Mm-hmm. You have to dig it up. You have to pay taxes, pay people, buy equipment, you know, pay rent. So it's economic substance and it's resulting in an asset. And that asset is exchangeable for services, for other people's assets. So people just inherently, I think humans, they like a currency that has an asset aspect to it.
Well, I almost think of it as the inverse of that psychologically, where people had gold and they didn't want to have to move gold back and forth when they traded each other. And so they come up with little gold coins as methods of like, this is a, just like what you have. This is a standard block of gold. And even that was too much. I want to buy a loaf of bread. Well, I'm not going to use a gold coin. I'm going to use a representation of that coin. So let's put aside the gold coin. I'm going to leave that at home. This bill is worth 10 of those coins. It's certified by the king. And so we know that's true. But meanwhile, people still think
that's where the problems start.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The problems start. Certified by the king.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you don't abide by it, well, I'll chop your hand off. When they trade the bills back in the day, they trade the bills representative of the shells, they think of like, I'm giving you the gold, right? Same thing here, right? Yeah. When I buy the ETF, I'm buying the ETF, I'm buying the token. I'm owning cryptographically this address, but in my mind, it's like it's worth. I'm really buying the diamond.
You own this,
right?
And you actually own this.
And there's a lot. I mean, that it's funny how it goes full circle because it used to be that we're using cash to represent the trading of gold. Now we're buying the diamonds to make the currency stable. So the purpose would be the currency, right?
Well, and stability is the key. Mm-hmm. So the economic input that's required to dig up gold and distribute it, that's not going to radically change month to month. So there's a floor for gold. You can't replace gold for less than, you know, $900 an ounce. You can't replace it. So that creates a floor, and that also dampens the volatility. That's the benefit of an asset-backed currency. And we're doing the same thing with diamonds. What's different about this is imagine you have this token for the first time. The token always represents a coin or a bar. That same token, in one day, you and I might trade it spot, meaning that I own the coin in the morning, you own it at noon. And it's never moved. It's still sitting in Brinks. So we did a spot trade. I sold it to you so that you could deliver it to a futures broker to settle a futures contract. So now that token is a futures contract. That's the counterparty to that futures contract. Use that token to create a ETF basket. Mm. So in 20 minutes, you went from spot to futures to ETF asset, which is a share. So this morphed from four different asset types with extremely little friction. It's just a block, you know, it's an ERC-20 transaction, which can, you know, cost a couple bucks. That is a network effect where for the first time you have an asset that's part of a network and it's all tied together by the electronics in here that it can propagate between all of those different asset types almost instantaneously. So if you have demand for the futures or demand for the ETF, it instantly is reflected in everything else. And it's very interesting. It's a really a breakthrough new asset in that respect. And we call it a smart commodity.
Yeah. I like
that. Smart because it knows where it goes.
Yeah. The last I could see was that you had approval to launch this, hadn't launched it yet. Is there a date when the ETF and it will,
which
ETF,
part?
The ETF?
Oh, so, we have two ETFs in development. We did file an ETF in partnership with the New York Stock Exchange. So they agreed to list it, but we started to work with the SEC. The SEC really wants us to launch the Futures product first. And we do have approval for that. That will be launching on the CME. And it's a futures contract where every contract is either two bars or 20 coins. You can settle it either way, but it's a physical settlement. And we expect that to launch late this year, probably third quarter, fourth quarter. We'll launch the futures.
Can I pause you right there?
Can't launch until after that. Yeah.
When you say futures contract, can you define that, what that would look like practically when you roll it out?
So it started with farmers.
Uh-huh.
So a futures contract, you know, farmer has wheat, the farmer, someone who is a baker, the baker wants to make a deal today for wheat in 3 months. The farmer would like to sell his wheat today and know what he has to work with as far as the market. So futures contracts are just a contract to deliver a commodity on a future date at a pre-agreed price. And in the meantime, if I agree to buy your wheat for $70 a bushel, I could sell that right. If wheat goes up, I might sell it for $85 a bushel to somebody else. So futures are a way to trade day by day commodities that are going to be delivered in the future. So in our case, you're agreeing today to deliver two of these bars in the future. Now, the reason we want that is if you're Tiffany's and you have $1 billion worth of diamond inventory and you're afraid diamonds may shoot up or diamonds may collapse. So Tiffany's can actually sell a futures contract at a particular price. And then they know that gives them the right to buy diamonds in the future or it'll hedge their inventory should there be a big change in the market. So the biggest use of futures is number one for producers and users that they can protect their price. So all the airlines, they buy futures of oil so that if there's a big spike, they already bought a future that says you have to deliver it at $50 a barrel. The other thing that's important for us, though, is the futures market is what's called a national market price. It's an SEC-approved exchange. Right now, for example, if we have our tokens trading on Bittrex or T0 or Coinbase, SEC doesn't respect those prices because they're not national markets. So the futures contract give us like an official SEC-eligible price for the market.
And the reason to list on the exchanges is just liquidity. There's just more visibility and liquidity than if you were to just list in the purely crypto world, like on Binance or Coinbase?
Oh, well, I mean, our product is largely institutional. So, the investors who buy the coins and bars, they're hedge funds, they're high net worth individuals, family offices. Right now, and over time, as I mentioned, BlackRock Fund, Executive Fund was one of our first big investors. A lot of investors are planning to add diamonds to their funds as a natural resource, as a mining and metals, as a inflation hedge, as a real asset. So there's lots of funds that want to have diamond commodities. A lot of them need to have a national market price. But the key reason for us listing is we list on digital exchanges to provide liquidity for our clients. We list on national markets to enable investors.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually it'll be an ETF. And I was going to say, we're actually planning to launch the ETF in Canada first. There's a different legal structure in Canada. But also I learned something interesting. If you invest in a diamond fund or a gold fund, for that matter, like GLD, the capital gains tax is 28%. If you invest in gold, it's a 28% tax on your profit. But if you invest in a Canadian gold fund, it's only 15% tax, which is the normal capital gains.
Hmm.
So we've been working with one of the large Canadian banks, and we're preparing to launch on the TSX to launch the ETF there first.
So what is that? Is that some unique gold tax only applicable in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's an IRS regulation for precious metals in general, diamonds included. So it's 28% capital gains on what's called collectibles, which includes art, cars. So if you have a capital gain on any one of those collectibles, the IRS charges you 28% instead of 15%,
wow.
Which is what you have for stocks.
That's terrible. That seems like a really dumb law. Why would they do that? Doesn't that disincentivize trading of everything, art and precious metals? I mean, why would they want to
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the government has a very fickle history with precious metals, you know, that they seized all the precious metals back in the day, you know, before World War II. And the gold standard, you know, with that Nixon finally got off. So governments and gold are always a little, little funny.
Yeah. Now it's Bitcoin. We were chatting earlier. You had some graphs. Is there anything that you wanted to underscore or talk about in terms of trends or visual?
Well, it's one thing I'll mention because we haven't talked about it. Are you able to see my screen?
The suspense. It's my first time actually doing a screen share, so we'll see. Oh, yeah, I can see it.
Oh, there it goes. So something interesting happened with uranium last year, because like diamonds, an investor really could never invest in uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And until Sprott and a group in the UK called Yellowcake, they, around the same time, they launched the first uranium funds. And these funds actually bought uranium. And they would hold it in barrels. It's this liquid uranium product. And since those funds launched, uranium went up 77%. And according to S&P, that price spike in uranium was strictly because the funds were able to buy for the first time. And so the impact of the fund, you know, like it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, the impact of the fund drove the market. Now, diamonds are really interesting, as we mentioned, because they were left behind compared to gold and silver. So this is a 20-year chart, and it's hard to tell the order of magnitude, but the white is silver, the yellow is gold. They both went up over 4x over 20 years. In fact, gold and silver both outperformed the S&P 500 over 20 years.
Wow.
S&P only went up 300%. Gold went up 500% over the last 20 years. But at the very bottom, the purple, that's diamonds. Diamonds returned 0% over 19 years, but they've returned 45% over 1 year, which is since we launched the diamond, since we got approval for the diamond standard commodity. Diamonds are up 45%. And actually, diamonds have outperformed the S&P 500 over the last 18 months. And gold by a lot. Gold has been flat.
And you know that you had an impact on the diamond market? You feel...
Some.
Yeah.
A lot of it is really because of jewelry, as I mentioned.
Okay, yeah.
The mines were shut down.
Yeah.
And the consumers were buying jewelry. So it was really jewelry buying. We didn't start buying largely until December. And you might look at December on this chart. It's right around here.
And the idea here is that if they say 15% of the market all of a sudden was available for investors in standardized packets that they could trade, then the pricing efficiency would go up. So the total money in the market would go up because people would put money into diamonds knowing that they had the trust in the, what would you call that? Like the market dynamics? Why does the price go up when you standardize it?
Well, the price goes up because of demand. It's very simple, supply and demand. And basically diamonds are going to, over a period of a few years, maybe it's 3 years, maybe it's 7 years, but in a short amount of time, diamonds are going to catch up with palladium in that you have ETFs, you have futures, you have options, you have these funds. So the Black Rocks, the State Streets, the JP Morgans of the world, they're going to build positions from zero. And that's completely new demand against diamonds, which, as I mentioned, globally, diamond jewelry has consumed more diamonds. So diamonds have spiked up since 2020. And in every market, jewelry demand is up. And now you have investor demand going up at the same time.
Wow.
We think that's going to drive prices as we launch all of these products.
Wow.
So we already have approval for futures and options right now. And now we're launching our private fund, but soon we're going to launch an ETF.
And is there any difference in accessibility between large hedge funds and individual retail investors? Or is it all the same accessibility? There's no...
Yeah. Right now it's all the same. So right now, people just go to our website, diamondstandard.co, and they can order the commodity from us. Pretty soon we're launching on two exchanges, which will do direct exchange offerings. But over time we're shifting to a primary dealer model, which is a lot like treasuries. So when the government sells treasuries, they have a weekly auction that they auction to dealers, and then the dealers distribute them to investors. So pretty soon we're going to stop selling directly to consumers, and we're going to sell only to the Fidelities of the world, or the brokers like the Goldman Sachs. And then they'll distribute to asset managers through their trading desks.
Oh, so you'll stop selling them? DiamondStandard.co will stop selling diamonds directly?
Yes. Yes. The coins. Everything will go through distributors.
And the reason?
But this is what I was mentioning as far as the supply.
Oh, wow. Look at that. Wow.
Every precious metal.
Is this the graph that convinced you that's to start this company?
This is exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, well,
my wife is a diamond dealer and I figured out how big that market is, and I realized it was a computer science problem.
Wow, that's fascinating. And it just seems like, yeah, like you said, exactly. There's no standardization of diamonds, so do that first and then introduce the liquidity, allow people to trade it.
The last thing I'll mention, which I think is super interesting, is you may have heard the term commodities supercycle. And that's when, as we've seen, when commodities go up, like oil was kind of a big leader, that trickles down to the cost of everything we make. And that creates a supercycle where generally over 20 years, commodities all trade above their moving average. They're basically 20 years at a time. And it happens when there's a acceleration of inflation. Right now, inflation is 8.5%, which is the highest it's been since the early 80s. And this, all the commodity traders are telling us this is we're in the commodity supercycle. That means commodities go up. Generally, equities and bonds don't perform well in these scenarios. So we have kind of two supercycles at the same time. One, the general commodity supercycle, but now you have this diamond supercycle, which is when diamonds are accumulated for the first time to catch up with the other precious metals. We think diamonds will probably be the best performing commodity, not just asset in general.
And what is that, a 3-year time horizon or 5-year or 10-year that you think about this in?
You know, I told a lot of people, my guesstimate was 7 years.
Yeah.
You know, how long does it take for this to build up? You know, like the ETF is, you know, complicated. That's going to take us probably a year in the US to launch. But everybody says I was crazy, 7 years. They say things are much more compressed. And, you know, how often do you have a new asset that's uncorrelated? That's the other big thing. Diamonds are totally uncorrelated to everything. They may become more correlated, but they're uncorrelated. You can take delivery. They're very portable. They're very low cost to store. your asset is not somebody else's liability. There's a lot of, and there's inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Those factors together make diamonds just extremely attractive as an investment.
So an individual listening to this that's not working for a hedge fund that's interested in getting into diamonds, you said you're going to pull down the diamond coin and bar soon. Is the plan to launch the ETF and then pull down those? Or will there be a period of time where retail investors won't have access to buy diamonds through your exchange?
Yeah, I would think it's within about 3 to 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
We'll stop, because it's with the launch of the futures, and we're already launching the first fund, and so eventually we're gonna, you know, there's gonna be a huge demand by funds that we'll have to satisfy, and our problem is capacity.
Mm.
We can't produce unlimited commodities. We have to buy the diamonds every week. We have to sort, inspect, grade, assemble, settle globally. So we have a finite capacity
mm-hmm.
on what we're able to deliver. So eventually we're going to be supporting partners. You know, if an asset manager launches a fund, they're not going to launch it unless they know we can give them 20% of our capacity. They won't, you know, the right. price will go through the auction, but we won't be able to support individual consumers directly. They'll go through their broker.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you guys have to buy through the channels that you have, partners in local markets and everywhere else is where you're sourcing the diamonds from.
We buy through the exchange and we have, right now we have 1 million diamonds a week being listed on the exchange. So we can only buy through the exchange, except what we're launching later this year is going to be the world's largest diamond recycling company. And we're actually going to buy diamonds from consumers. And we have to. Because it turns out 85% of all diamonds have already been dug up and they're owned by consumers. So we have to buy your great aunt's ring, the divorcee's, you know, ring. You know, we have to buy back diamonds from consumers to supply this demand.
Or you could invest in rockets and go mine diamonds on asteroids.
We've looked into that. It's not economical yet on a kilo per, you know, the cost per kilo.
Yeah.
To send it up.
Maybe
someday.
Yeah, maybe someday is right. Cormac, thanks so much, man. I really enjoyed getting to know you and hearing about all the progress you guys have made and exciting plans you have for the future. Are you online writing anywhere personally at the site?
Yeah. So we have a blog on our site. We have a lot of research. I just did a webcast on LinkedIn where I walked through that deck. We looked at a couple slides. I walked through a lot more on LinkedIn, and that's available on our site. So you can download that whole deck, and it's the whole investment thesis for anybody that's interested.
It's awesome. Are you personally on Twitter or any social medias that you want to throw out there?
I'm on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I have a Twitter. Keep it simple. My company tweets for me, but I'm more, I don't go on many podcasts.
Yeah.
I don't go to many conferences.
Yeah.
I'm a homebody.
Yeah.
I like to build.
Yeah.
I really love to build.
A freaking man to that. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for sharing your time with me then. I feel especially honored.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. It's great talking to you.
Take care, man.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts, tweet about it, or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.